So our first speaker of today is Dr. Silke Holtmans. She has an impressive amount of publications, actually. I stopped counting at the 45th, and the list was going on and on and on. Pretty impressive. She also was previously a speaker at many different and other conferences, including the Black Hat conference. And today she's going to speak about SS7 and Diameter and the security aspects of both of these LTE protocols. The title of her talk is Mobile Data Interception from the Interconnection Link. Please welcome her with a lot of applause.
Thanks a lot. As I said, my name is Silke Holtmans. I work for Nokia Bell Labs. That's a research brand of Nokia. I've been doing mobile security for 17 years. So everybody of you sitting here who has an LTE phone, or LTE-enabled phone, has a piece of something I designed in it. That's quite a nice feeling, actually. But this is not only my work, it's also from my colleague Jani Ekman, who works in our testing department, who sets up test networks so that we don't crash accidentally operators' networks when we make an update. So, and actually with our competitor, Cassel McDade from Adaptive Mobile, so we have been working actually together on this one. I will explain later how that has happened. So I will talk about mobile data interception from the interconnection link. And, well, let's start with the practicality. So this is something that's not so visible in public. Some of you might have been in 2014 here or 2008 when Tobias Engel or Carsten Noll presented their attacks. So for those who have not been there, so we are here in Leipzig. You are connected now to Vodafone, Deutsche Telekom, or Telefonica. And the meeting attendees here are international, so you will also have people from UK connected from, usually have a subscription from Three, from France, from Orange, from, if they are from Poland, maybe from Plus, or MTS when they are coming from Russia. I'm from Finland, well, I live nowadays in Finland, so my colleagues and family, they have ELISA, Telia, or DNA subscription. And there's a big difference to credit card system. In the credit card world, there's one big mother company. But for telecommunication operators, these are different legal entities in different countries. And still, you can just pop up in their network, switch your phone on, and you can get data or make voice calls or SMS, and you're charged to your home bill, and it works. So that's actually something to think about, because that's not happening automatically. And the reason why this is actually working is because there's something called interconnection link or IPX network. It's not the internet. It has touching points with the internet, but it's a private, separate network which enables mobile data communication or, in general, telecommunication. And actually, why this is such an important network, because we are all connected to it. Everybody here who has a switched-on phone is connected to it. And not just your phones. It's also tablets, if they are cellular-enabled. For example, there's a tablet with Android on it, let's say, to AT&T in Anchorage. There's a connected scale, let's say, to Verizon in US. Or there we have a car, connected car, which maybe from Telefonica in South America. In the bottom, you see there a gas meter from British Telecom, which is also cellular-enabled. Then we have there a fire alarm from Telstra. I heard they might need a fire alarm in case of a burning platform arrived there at their shores. I heard that something like that has arrived there. Our industrial automation, sort of assembly lines, which might have connectivity, cellular connectivity, and of course, classical phones. So you see there are all kind of different operating systems, all kind of different hardware. And they are connected to a local operator, and via that, they are connected to the interconnection network. So they can be reached from the interconnection network in case something arrives for them. To understand the security of interconnection, we need to go back a bit. So 1981, the interconnection network was established between four countries, Nordic countries. And you see there a beautiful picture of the Nordic mobile telephony, of the Nordic Nokia Talkman, as we Finns used to say. So it's sort of this size, and we weighed about 5 kilograms, so I didn't bring it. Very beautiful piece of hardware. And it was a closed and private network. So that was the main security feature of that network. It was closed and private, and nobody could get in, only the people that know each other. It was running the signaling system number 7 protocol. And that was a huge success. And they extended and extended it. And more operators joined, Latvia and so on, Estonia. And nowadays, we have all kinds of applications using it. You get your SMS reminder for your dentist or whatever, sort of your banking tons, whatever. And now we move towards the LTE Diomede protocols. And so just to give you an idea, sort of that's how it started. Probably Finland, Sweden, Norway, Denmark. And that's how they started. They probably went together in a sauna, having some good beer, and say, hey, let's do it. And they managed to do it. That's how it nowadays looks like. Sort of more has grown a bit. So we have that's 2G and 2.5G. Then we had 3G, a bit of 4G. And now we have also 5G. So it has gotten a bit more complex. So, and it's a sort of organically grown structures. And the thing is, everything is connected with everything else. So you see GSM networks, really old networks, connect to LTE networks, and the other way around. So sometimes there are nodes in the middle, sometimes not. So it's very, very sort of inhomogeneous, to call it that way. So back to security. I mean, the main security feature of this jungle was that it's closed and private. Now let's revisit this assumption, sort of 35 years later, and see what has happened. Is it still closed and private? I'm afraid to say no. There are different angles to closed and private. On the top, you see there are three. I could have chosen any European operator. That's not particularly to three. It's just in the European Union wanted to encourage competition so that mobile virtual network operators have very easy to establish their business. So, for example, supermarket chains are now selling here subscriptions, for example, in Germany. So they rent their services from a traditional operator. And all operators in the European Union are forced to rent out the services that they have themselves, which includes roaming, to anybody who has basically come and asked and has a proper business model. That makes it also makes it easier for nasty guys to buy the interconnection access. In the middle, there cell phone reports, cell phone interception. These are from the darknet, from a company called Interceptor, but they have a horrible service, so I wouldn't recommend that company. They are not answering to emails or anything, but they are claiming to rent out these kind of services. So the access can also gain from the darknet by just buying it. Here on the bottom, we see a screenshot from Shoden. You see here this GGSN. You might not know which node this is, but I can tell you a GGSN has no reason to be on the internet. It shouldn't be there. I don't know why it is there. Maybe it's a honeypot, so I don't suggest to hack that, so you never know what comes back. Then we have on the right-hand side here a GPRS Aircel. Aircel is a big operator in India. And they seem to have their GPRS nodes on the internet. The protocol here is SMMP. That's a simple network management protocol. And it's used. And with above that, there's a telnet login. My personal assumption is that somebody was on call duty to fix the network and didn't want to go into office. So he just set himself up this telnet access so he could easily configure the stuff from home. But these things happen. That's life. But, well, of course, telnet login, you throw in a sort of password cracker and see what you have. Admin is always worth a try. Then there, this map is a bit older. That's from the WikiLeaks, from the Snowden leaks. And it's showing the countries which the NSA says they have access to the phone network. It's probably no longer up to date. I think the situation, in particularly in Europe, has improved substantially since then. And on the top, there's an article from The Intercept where the GCHQ, basically the British spy, hacked Belgacom. But that was the GPRS transport protocol. So I think it's fair to say that there are points where the network is no longer that closed and private. So hackers, they may just rent a service, they hack their way in. Having power, in some countries, the line between government and telecommunication providers not so strict, let's call it that way. And if the government wants to have access, they just get access. Of course, there's a classical bribing of an employee that always works, just amount of question, probably amount of money. But you can become an operator, or you can do social engineering. That has also been seen, but that's a quite rare case, actually. Social engineering is not so common, but the other ones are sort of more likely. So let's do a brief recap. SS7, that's the old protocol. And there were attacks. These are the attacks that exist for the old signaling system number 7, which is still most commonly used on the interconnection link. We have their location tracking that was published, I think, in 2008, very coarse granularity by Tobias. Then we have eavesdropping, fraud, denial of service on the user network, credential theft, that are the cryptographic keys that are stored also on your SIM card that are used for confidentiality and authentication. Data session hijacking, but that's not SS7, that's actually GTP protocol. Unblocking of stolen phones, that is an implementation-specific attack, not from our nodes, I'm happy to say. SMS interception, basically that's pretty risky because of all the one-time password theft, because nowadays many password reset systems send you one-time code, and the attacker can actually trigger this sending of the one-time code. So depending on the system used, it's more or less vulnerable to it. So, and there are even on YouTube videos how that works. So this is basically the situation for SS7. Those attacks were sort of done by P1, Positive Technologies, Carsten Noll, Tobias Engel. And these are sort of some, I'm focusing more on diameter security. So that's basically the SS7, the old protocol. And that's the status of the security for the IPX network. The SS7 is still most commonly used, but things slowly move forward. The communication is sometimes direct, sometimes intermediate nodes involved, depending. For example, we are here now in Germany. I don't think there exists a specific cable from Germany, let's say, to Tuvalu. That's a Pacific island. I think with 2,000 people living there, something like that. So, but they have their own operator. So I don't think there exists an explicit cable from here to there. So there are probably some intermediate nodes involved if you make a phone call to Tuvalu. But some operators also have direct personal pipes with their most common partners. For example, in Frankfurt, it's such a big hub. Also nowadays, some deploy SS7 firewalls. I think that was a big achievement of the presentation done here in 2014, that really something happened afterwards. The first firewall products came up, and also operators started to deploy it. So not all have them, but it's better now. But there's no form of transport security, no IPsec, no TLS, no DTLS, no MAP security, no source authentication or confidentiality protection, and no integrity. That's how it is. No fun, but that's it. So, diameter, new fun, new rule, new protocol, new game, everything is better. Let's see. yeah. All will be better with LTE and diameter. I've heard that from one company. I'm not going to say which company that was. When I would say, well, all will be different. We have a different protocol, but it's doing roughly the same things. As a user, you still move from A to place B. You move from one antenna to the next antenna. So the logic for handover and subscriber profile management and things like that, they are pretty similar. They're not exactly the same, but they're pretty similar. So it's possible that some things are just sort of converted. Let's call it that way. Attacks, they are reality. I've seen myself some attacks, quite many actually. I've been doing traces analysis, looking at the traces and trying to figure out what the heck is that. And there's one important question one needs to ask, sort of, why should attackers stop just because we have a different protocol? Come on. They make money with it, or they are governments, intelligence communities. They say, for them, it's sort of all you can eat data, give me all your data. They track VIPs. I don't know. And there are these kind of service companies. Basically, you have to know that some governments have their own agencies which do stuff, and other governments, they just hire service companies because it's cheaper. Because a service company sells to several governments, that means they can offer per government the things cheaper. Also, governments have budgets. So there are these kind of service companies. Also, there are just entities which make money from it, fraud. And also military uses mobile network data for target localization. For example, in The Intercept, it was published that, I think they called it drones paper, that about 70% of the data for
Karin Ulrich wird die zweite Hälfte bestreiten. Karin ist wissenschaftliche Mitarbeiterin in Amsterdam, im Amsterdam Machine Learning Lab. Und sie forscht direkt zu den Algorithmen des Machine Learning, insbesondere Bayesian Methods, hat also einen Hintergrund im Deep Learning und der Informationstheorie. Ich bin wissenschaftlicher Mitarbeiter im Institut für Informationsmanagement Bremen und mir geht es um die Nutzererfahrung von Machine Learning, insbesondere das Vertrauen. Wir würden jetzt gerne anfangen mit einem Beispiel, das jeder kennt, Spam-Erkennung. Benutzt wahrscheinlich jeder hier, funktioniert auch nicht immer. Aber man muss sich wirklich vor Augen führen, dass es eine beeindruckende technische Leistung ist, ne, auch wenn es manchmal nicht funktioniert. Und wir nehmen es hier, um den Unterschied zwischen imperativer Programmierung und maschinellem Lernen zu verdeutlichen. Imperative Programmierung ist das, woran wahrscheinlich jeder denkt, wenn er an Informatik und Programmierung denkt. Ne, es geht um Regeln und Anweisungen. Wenn X, dann Y. Das Wort Imperativ für Befehl steckt ja auch schon im Namen. Und wenn wir jetzt Spam imperativ erkennen wollen würden, dann würde man zum Beispiel gucken, okay, das Wort Viagra wird so geschrieben in der Nachricht vorkommen, dann ist es eine Spam-Nachricht. Andererseits ist es eine gutartige Nachricht. Maschinelles Lernen ist jetzt ein komplett anderer Ansatz. Da hat man eine Vorhersage, die man iterativ, also immer und immer wieder verbessert. Für die Spam-Klassifikation versucht man zum Beispiel Kombinationen von Wörtern zu finden, durch die es wahrscheinlich wird, dass es sich um Spam handelt. Der Kernbegriff ist hier also wahrscheinlich. Und das sieht dann so aus, dass man für viele verschiedene Beispiele prognostiziert, ob eine Nachricht Spam ist oder nicht. Dann berechnet man einen Fehler mit einer geeigneten Fehlerfunktion. Und dann ändert man seine Parameter, um den Fehler zu verringern. Und geht wieder zum ersten Schritt und macht das immer und immer wieder. Natürlich ist es nicht ganz so einfach, diesen Fehler zu berechnen und auch die Parameter zu verändern, ist ein eigenes Forschungsgebiet. Aber im Kern ist es wirklich so simpel, wie wir es hier darstellen. Und deswegen ist es spannend, im Hinterkopf zu behalten. Dass Spam-Erkennen nicht mit Textverständnis gleichzusetzen ist. Das heißt, der Algorithmus muss sich erst Kafka verstehen können, um zu erkennen, ob etwas Spam ist oder nicht. Und dieses Problem, dass etwas wirkungsvoller aussieht, als es vermeintlich ist, wird uns im Laufe des Vortrags noch begegnen. Wir haben jetzt ein weiteres, immer noch vereinfachtes Beispiel für eine Entscheidungshilfe hier aus der Medizin. Das Ziel ist hier die Erkennung von Brustkrebs. Statt Wörtern wie beim Spam haben wir verschiedene Features, das heißt Charakteristika, an denen man zum Beispiel gutartigen von bösartigen Brustkrebs unterscheiden kann. Dazu gehören hier der Radius, die Textur, Umfang, Fläche, Glätte, aber auch so Sachen wie die Symmetrie und die Zahl konkaver Punkte, also nach innen gewölbter Punkte.